your fault. Baby, it's not mine. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make dab in the middle of it. Grass make dab in the middle. We are grass make dab in the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Our second hour tonight is a previous interview I had with Roger Stone. It's a rebroadcast of about a year ago. And The Making of a President, and it was his book that he wrote about how President Trump was triumphant in his election to the presidency of the United States. And but to start off tonight, we're going to play an audio clip of Hannity. Sean Hannity has been standing up on this memo that's just recently been exposed and released by Nunes and his committee. His committee is the House Intelligence Committee on the House side. And Nunes has been the chairman there along with Schiff. But he's been in secretly having a subcommittee investigate and using all kinds of classified information at times to uncover the FISA problem. And what happened there, the FISA is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And there's a FISA court that you have to take evidence into to get warrants for wiretapping or surveillance or intercepts. They call them intercepts to now in the intelligence business. So we're going to start off and play that clip there. And Hannity's been really the supreme guy up here. God, I must really respect what he's doing. He's hitting them hard on this. There's so many different corruptive types of going ons, you know, in our government, that it's hard, and previous to Barack Obama and all them, that it's hard to pick and choose. But anyway, we're going to listen to this. This was last Friday night. Hannity lays out this latest memo, this FISA memo, and they made it available, the committee has, to the congressional members in the House. There's about 160 people that have seen it, and they're calling for it to be released to the public. But anyway, listen to this very carefully right now.
All right, on to our big top story tonight. Alarming, shocking. People will go to jail. Comparisons to KGB tactics. Well, that is how lawmakers tonight are describing the biggest scandal in American history that the media is trying to ignore. They will not be able to. Now, Sarah Carter is reporting tonight that more than 130 members have actually gone to see the explosive classified memo that shows systematic FISA abuses against the Trump campaign and an incoming president. And according to Sarah Carter, the vast majority of those members of Congress, they happen to be Republicans. In fact, only Democrats, the only ones to look at the four-page memo, are the ones who are on the House Intelligence Committee, and only one other Democrat we know of actually took the time and went over to look at it today. And Democrats on that House committee, by the way, who are the ones that voted to keep it secret from Congress, they don't want you to see it. So what are the Democrats trying to cover up in this particular case? What are they hiding here? Who are they protecting here? And why do they want to keep it a secret? Now, tonight, we are demanding that this information be released to you, the public, because the American people, you need to know about this huge and massive abuse of power and how the Obama administration has weaponized the powerful tools of intelligence, and how the Clinton bought and paid for phony Russian dossier was actually used to not only spy on the Trump campaign, but also to get a FISA warrant based on lies. So we're asking tonight that you call your members of Congress. There's the number. It's on your screen. 202-224-3121. Tell your members of Congress, release the memo. That's it. If you're on Twitter, hashtag release the memo. We're going to put the number up throughout the show tonight. Now, I know a lot of you have been writing and asking, well, why is it taking so long? We have been since March. We reported first then about this abuse that the Trump campaign had a FISA warrant that was issued against them. That was back in March. We have been unpeeling the layers of this onion, this massive scandal. And it is so imperative. We've now gotten to this point that you need to see this information for yourself. We hope you'll call the number on your screen. Demand, just release the memo. Tell the truth to the American people. Because we have a few powerful people in the intelligence community. Well, they thought they knew better than we did, than you did, about who should be the president. They abused their position. They tried to influence, steal, rig an election. Now, all that needs to happen is this. The House Intelligence Committee, they need to vote to release this information to the public. They will then send it to the White House, so I would assume would sign off on it. So in reality, with enough pressure, this could be done in a matter of days. And sources familiar with this memo, they are telling us that the contents of this memo are so severe and so shocking that it will lead to the firing of people at the highest levels of the FBI and the DOJ. Now, please keep this in mind, as we said earlier. Everything that we are telling you tonight, it's only a small portion of what will be coming out throughout this year. It's going to take time. We're going to need your patience. But the first explosive evidence is now available. Think back to Watergate. Watergate was a third-rate break-in, a group of people trying to cover up, you know, a break-in at the Watergate Hotel to get information on an opposition candidate. This scandal is about the systemic abuse of power, the weaponizing of the powerful tools of intelligence against an opposition party during an election year, and in the process shredding our Constitution, our Fourth Amendment constitutional protections against unreasonable search and seizure, all in a plot to impact and rig and steal an election. That's how important this is. And I don't care if you're a liberal, a conservative, a Republican and Democrat. You need to care about this because we will lose our constitutional republic if we don't get to the bottom of this. And when all this information finally sees the light of day, it will remove any doubt that the special counsel, Robert Mueller, his team of partisan Democratic donors need to be disbanded and their witch hunt needs to be shut down immediately. And as we showed you last night, these are the key players in all this. They are high-ranking Obama, FBI, and DOJ officials. And a lot more information about them will be coming out in just the next couple of weeks. I think the latest we will get this is around January 30th, but we need to see it sooner. We also know that the Trump-hating FBI agent Peter Strzok and his FBI lawyer mistress, Lisa Page, they're at the center of everything here. And we know from the released text messages that they called then-candidate Trump an idiot, loathsome, a lonesome human being, F Trump. And there are still 9,600 text messages that we have not seen yet. And one particular message really gets to the heart of what we've been trying to find out. And this is between Peter Strzok and Page. And now it makes a lot more sense knowing what we know. Now, back in August, Strzok wrote to Lisa Page, well, I want to believe the path that you threw out for consideration in Andy's office, that there's no way he gets elected, but I'm afraid we can't take that risk. It's like an insurance policy in the unlikely event that you die before you're 40. Now, we, of course, believe that was Andy McCabe, the FBI director, of course, Andrew McCabe. And we also are believing tonight, and we have very strong evidence to corroborate this, that Lisa Page was the key counsel for McCabe. You see, the nexus here, you got Lisa Page, you got Peter Strzok, you got Andrew McCabe. What's the insurance policy? Talking about an insurance policy in case Donald Trump wins the election and Hillary loses. And at the same time, then you have the Obama administration. They're trying to obtain a FISA warrant to spy on the Trump campaign. And they say, allegedly, it's about Carter Page, but we know it's a pretext. And sources are telling us that the first request for the warrant was rejected. They said no, which rarely happens. And that's when the Clinton bought and paid for phony Russian propaganda dossier was then used. Now, that dossier put the request over the top. Then they were granted the FISA warrant, and that allowed the Obama administration to begin the systemic abuse of FISA spying powers to target a candidate, an opposing candidate, an opposition party in an election. And this is part of the important Fusion GPS, now co-founder Glenn Simpson. Now, he testified. This was released yesterday. He didn't even bother to verify what was in the dossier. He just trusted the person he's paying, British spy Christopher Steele, even though Steele is known to have paid Russians for information. And by the way, his very skilled nature is what? His skill is deception. And we're learning from the Simpson testimony that the Clinton campaign and the DNC knew he was reacting, in other words, and reaching out to the media outlets to try and get them to write stories about the fabricated Russian dossier. So just like we've been telling you, Clinton bought and paid for a dossier, $12 million. It was going right through one lawyer through her campaign, right through another lawyer through the DNC, which she was controlling. In it, what do we have? Russian lies, salacious lies, all in an attempt. She rigged the election against Bernie. Now she's trying to rig the election against Trump. Comey and Strzok, well, they exonerate her before an investigation. You get it? There's a lot of rigging here. I know this is a lot to absorb, but there are so many questions. We need to know who knew what, when, and where. And let me tell you this tonight. Andrew McCabe, if you're watching, you need to be fired and you need to be investigated. And by the way, so does the Trump-hating FBI agent, Peter Strzok, fired and investigated. His FBI lawyer mistress, fired and investigated. Lisa Page, gone. Demoted DOJ official Bruce Orr, who met with Fusion GPS before and after, removed, fired, and investigated. James Comey, who we know rigged, in other words, gave an exoneration before investigation, we learned today is reportedly going to teach an ethical leadership class at William & Mary. You've got to be kidding. Anyway, he needs to be investigated, and he may want to hire a lawyer instead. Maybe an ethical one at that. Rod Rosenstein, you need to explain your role in all of this, and specifically if you were involved in extending this FISA warrant. And frankly, Rod Rosenstein needs to be fired. And finally tonight, Special Counsel Robert Mueller, his corrupt and biased investigation needs to be shut down once and for all. It was predicated on lies from the beginning. The country has suffered enough, and it has been unfair, inaccurate, untrue, and extremely and extraordinarily and abusively biased in their tactics and their hiring of people with questionable ethics who in the past have withheld exculpatory evidence, were overturned 9-0 in the Supreme Court. People went to jail, and that was overturned in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeal. And you only hired people that donated to Barack Obama, Hillary, and, of course, the DNC. What we are uncovering here is far worse than Watergate. People need to be held accountable, especially when you have congressmen that saw the memo, that say the memo is likely to send people to jail. This is a massive abuse of power, a major violation and a shredding of America's constitutional principles. The powerful tools of intelligence were abused by the people at the top, not the rank and file, not the FBI, you know, agents out there working hard to protect us every day, not the people in the intelligence community that protect us every day. These were people at the top. Instead, they weaponized those tools of intelligence to spy on an opposition party, and it is why tonight we are asking you to help us and demand that this memo be released to the American people that will begin the process, only begin it, to show the abuse that has taken place for the American people. Call the number at the bottom of your screen, and I hope you will demand to release the memo. Hashtag release the memo. Here with reaction, Fox News national security strategist and former deputy assistant to the president, Sebastian Gorka, Fox News contributor, investigative reporter Sarah Carter, Fox News legal analyst Greg Jarrett. Sarah, I want to go back to where we were last night. This was back in March of 26th of last year that you literally first said, wait a minute, we've discovered that a FISA warrant was obtained to spy on, you know, then candidate Trump and maybe another warrant, you and John Solomon breaking the story.
That's right.
Explain to my friends that are so impatient why it's taking so long, because it's been literally a layer of onion a day.
Because we've had to have the evidence, and each piece of this puzzle is another piece of evidence that we could deliver to the American people and to Congress. And when Congress took over and when the Department of Justice took over, they're unraveling, they're moving forward with the investigations that we weren't privy to because we couldn't access the classified information. It is so important to understand that had we not looked into this, had Hillary Clinton won, we would have never known that this was happening. And this is exactly what they expected to happen. This is why they got so lazy. This is why we see those text messages between Peter Strzok and Lisa Page. And now, Sean, this is really interesting. You know, before I got here, I was contacted by law enforcement officials, both former FBI and current, and they were saying to me, get the text messages from Andy McCabe. Get his text messages. Find out what was going on there, because there's a lot more where Lisa Strzok and where Peter Strzok and Lisa Page left off. There's a lot more to be seen there. And, you know, once again, this is one piece of the puzzle at a time. And this is what we've got to do to uncover the truth. And I think that the American people will be just as shocked as Congress. And I think they're going to get those answers very shortly.
Greg Jarrett, let's go to the legal side of this. You have been examining every aspect of it. Tell us where we are, and do you agree with my calls for the firings? Anybody you disagree with?
Oh, absolutely. Top officials should be impeached, which means they can't hold another government position. But I suspect this intel document is going to reveal multiple felonies by high-ranking officials at the FBI and the Department of Justice. There's a federal felony statute. It's called deprivation of rights under color of law. And it says that a government official cannot use their position of power to deprive somebody of their constitutional rights. Here, it's the constitutional right to privacy as upheld by the Supreme Court. So if the FBI and the DOJ goes into a federal judge using a fake false document to obtain a warrant to spy, that's a violation. It's a felony. It's 10 years behind bars. People ought to be prosecuted for that.
Eddie, is there anyone you disagree with that should be fired? And do you agree that the special counsel, Robert Mueller, needs to be disbanded because it was all done on false pretenses and it seems it was all done illegally?
Well, one of the congressmen who saw this four-page intel document said yesterday, people ought to be fired, and he named names. And one of them, in addition to Bruce Orr, is Rod Rosenstein, who's the acting attorney general in the Mueller investigation. He's Mueller's boss. He's overseeing it. If he goes, Mueller should go, and so should his investigation.
Dr. Gorka, you were in the White House for a big period of this time. I've got to imagine this becomes very distracting, and the fact that it's all predicated on something that is false, erroneous, and that we've had no evidence for in a year, probably frustrating to you.
Well, it was, but the president told me one day in the Oval, just the two of us, that they will find nothing because there is no Russian collusion. So the president must be commended for being completely hands-off with regards to all these absurd allegations and investigations. But I have to repeat and emphasize something you said in your monologue, Sean. Just before I came to the studio, I spoke to my sources as well. The memo is the tip of the iceberg. That refers to DOJ and FBI malfeasance and felonious activity weaponizing intelligence against U.S. citizens. But it goes much higher.
Do you agree with that too?
It goes much higher.
Agreed.
Oh, absolutely.
And
I agree. And remember, Sean, it was about the FISA. It was about FISA 702, abusing that system. And remember, they collect everything. This is not just about foreigners. There's a collection of all Americans. So every call that's made overseas, every email, everything. I want to know how many people within the Trump campaign and within the Trump administration,
exactly,
they were actually...
How many people?
How
and
many?
Surveilled and unmasked and leaked upon.
It's Obamagate,
so sure. I want to say this. All of you have been amazing. Thank you for your hard work in the last year. We have another year of hard work ahead. Ed Henry next on the government shutdown.
This scandal that's been brewing, and this is just one of the scandals, is this came out of the dossier, the Steele dossier that was bandied about before the election. And this is getting into the most horrendous. It makes Watergate look like a nursery a boy scandal. You know what I mean? This is really going to be devastating for the Democrats. And they're stating in here, several of the members of the panel tonight on the Hannity show stated that they could go to jail over some of this. But this is getting very, very serious. We have a couple of clips here from Paul Krug and also Joseph Stiglitz. And they were predicting, 6 months to a year before the election about the economics and the economics that Trump was advocating. And they were predicting what might happen to those, to the economy if Trump were elected president. But anyway, this is the first one by Paul Krugman.
Let's imagine a Trump victory, a Trump presidency. What do you worry about economy-wise? What do you think would be significant impacts of that?
Well, you would be getting somebody who has, I mean, even aside from ideology, right, left, taxes, deficits, you'd just be getting somebody who has no idea, just complete blank about how does this thing work. No idea that some treaties, that trade treaties are not abrogated casually. No idea, I mean, this is a guy on national security who asks, why we have these nukes, why don't we use them? So what do you think he's going to do on economic policy? It's just going to be wildly, wildly erratic. It's just no reason to believe that we would have any kind of rational policy.
So then presumably there's an outcome distribution. I wrote a thing a few months ago with like a risk curve chart, where like a Trump presidency might be bad, it might be really bad, it might be sort of okay. What do you worry about in the tail? What are like your, if you can give us like a top five, what do you worry about with Trump as president? What would he do?
Oh, gosh. In some ways, I worry that he might actually go with his original tax plan, with the trillions of dollars of lost revenue. And I mean, at the moment, inflation is the least of our problems, but if you work at it, we could have a hyperinflation in America, and he might do it. I mean, this guy really just doesn't know anything at all, and might be prepared to just say, budget constraints are for losers.
That was Paul Krugman predicting what kind of economy there would that would be if a Trump presidency was successful, if Donald Trump had been elected president. He's totally wrong. Now, here's another world economist, Joseph Stiglitz, and I believe he made this prediction a year ago at the Davos, or the World Economic Forum over in Davos, Switzerland. But anyway, we'll play that one for you next and see what you think about that. This is another one of these world economists making predictions about the future Trump economy, okay? Listen carefully.
There are so many ways in which Trump is wrong about the economy. I guess the best way of looking at it is in terms of how he translates whatever diagnosis, and it's often very difficult to figure out what his diagnosis is, into policy. One of the things that he would do is actually lower the tax rate on businesses throughout the United States in ways that would not necessarily stimulate investment. There are some ways you can change the tax structure to encourage investment. Investment tax credit, rewarding firms that invest in the United States relative to those that don't. But what he's doing is, while criticizing the growth and the deficit, made a set of proposals to make the deficit even larger, and to do it in ways that benefit very rich people like himself. People who, including those who've taken advantage of others, the hedge funds through the carried interest, the real estate agents, lowering taxes on real estate doesn't mean that there's more land. Nobody has ever shown that lowering tax rates on land leads to more land. So it gives no social benefit. But it really benefits those at the very top, not surprised to which a group to which he's very sensitive.
So there you have two world eminent, one that is consultant and quite a editorial contributor to the New York Times, Paul Krugman, and then Joseph Stiglitz has won a Nobel Prize. Both are Nobel laureates in economics, okay, at different times. So here we have world-renowned Nobel Prize winners in economics giving their opinion, which was totally wrong. And so much for their opinion. What's coming up next is Senator Flake on the floor of the Senate, and he's giving a speech, about, President Trump and so forth and fake news, and there's nobody in there listening to the speech. So he was speaking to an empty Senate chamber, and here's what he says, and he equates what Trump was saying and the way he acts to Joseph Stalin, and I think, boy, that is so far off base. I mean, that's not even close to being correct. But anyway, listen to this second.
Mr. President, near the beginning of the document that made us free, our Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson wrote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident." So from the very beginning, our freedom has been predicated on truth. The founders were visionary in this regard, understanding well that good faith and shared facts between the governed and the government would be the very basis of this ongoing idea of America. As a distinguished former member of this body, Daniel Patrick Moynihan of New York, famously said, "Everyone is titled to his own opinion, but not his own facts." Now, during this past year, I'm alarmed to say that Senator Moynihan's proposition has likely been tested more severely than at any time in our history. For it is that reason that I rise today to talk about the truth and the truth's relationship to democracy. For without truth and a principled fidelity to truth and to shared facts, Mr. President, our democracy will not last. 2017 was a year which saw the truth, objective, empirical, evidence-based truth, more battered and abused than at any time in the history of our country, at the hands of the most powerful figure in our government. It was a year which saw the White House enshrine alternative facts into the American lexicon as justification for what used to be simply called old-fashioned falsehoods. It was a year in which an unrelenting daily assault on the constitutionally protected free speech was launched by the same White House, an assault that is as unprecedented as it is unwarranted. The enemy of the people was how the President of the United States called the free press in 2017. Mr. President, it is a testament to the condition of our democracy that our own president uses words infamously spoken by Joseph Stalin to describe his enemies. It bears noting that so fraught with malice was the phrase enemy of the people that even Nikita Khrushchev forbade its use, telling the Soviet Communist Party that the phrase had been introduced by Stalin for the purpose of, quote, annihilating such individuals, unquote, who disagreed with the supreme leader. This alone should be the source of great shame for us in this body, especially for those of us in the president's party, for they are shameful, repulsive statements. And of course, the president has it precisely backward. Despotism is the enemy of the people. The free press is the despot's enemy, which makes the free press the guardian of democracy. When a figure in power reflexively calls any press that doesn't suit him fake news, it is that person who should be the figure of suspicion, not the press. I dare say that anyone who has had the privilege and awesome responsibility to serve in this chamber knows that these reflexive slurs of fake news are dubious at best. Those of us who travel overseas, especially to war zones and other troubled areas all around the globe, encounter members of U.S.-based media who risk their lives and sometimes lose their lives reporting on the truth. To dismiss their work as fake news is an affront to their commitment and their sacrifice. According to the International Federation of Journalists, 80 journalists were killed in 2017. A new report from the Committee to Protect Journalists documents that the number of journalists imprisoned around the world has reached 262, which is a new record. This total includes 21 reporters who are being held on false news charges. Mr. President, so powerful is the presidency that the damage done by the sustained attack on the truth will not be confined to this president's time in office. Here in America, We do not pay obeisance to the powerful. In fact, we question the powerful most ardently. To do so is our birthright and a requirement of our citizenship. And so, we know well that no matter how powerful, no president will ever have dominion over objective reality. No politician will ever get us or tell us what the truth is and what it is not. And anyone who presumes to try to attack or manipulate the press for his own purposes should be made to realize his mistake and to be held to account. That is our job here. That is just as Madison, Hamilton, and Jay would have it. Of course, a major difference between politicians and the free press is that the free press usually corrects itself when it's made a mistake. Politicians don't. No longer can we compound the attacks on truth with our silent acquiescence. No longer can we turn a blind eye or a deaf ear to those assaults on our institutions. And, Mr. President, an American president who cannot take criticism, who must constantly deflect and distort and distract, who must find someone else to blame, is charting a very dangerous path. And a Congress that fails to act as a check on the president adds to that danger. Now we are told via Twitter that today the president intends to announce his choice for the, quote, most corrupt and dishonest media awards. It beggars belief that an American president would engage in such a spectacle. But here we are.
Coming up next, I'm going to read the 10 winners of the fake news or whatever, the worst news stories in the country for 2017 that President Trump came up with. And what's interesting about this is at the top of the list is Paul Krugman. He says the markets will never recover from Trump. And this, the Dow hits an all-time high. Now, I think it's a mistake, though, that Trump is making in tying his administration to the Dow Jones average, because I think it's way overbought. And I think the price-to-earnings ratios are way out of line. So it's going to come down, and then the Democrats will blame Trump for the downfall, the downside of the Dow Jones at that time. So number one, this is the list that President Trump came out with. That he listed as his the 10 worst stories and fake news, you know, out there. Number one, the New York Times, Paul Krugman, claimed on the day of President Trump's historic landslide victory that the economy would never recover. Okay, number two, we have ABC News, Brian Ross, chokes and sends markets in a downward spiral with false report. And he bungled a deal, citing that there was a collusion during his campaign, and it was a total mistake, and he was suspended without pay for a number of weeks. Number three, CNN falsely reported that candidate Donald Trump and his son Donald J. Trump Jr. had access to hacked documents from WikiLeaks. They bought that. Number four. Okay, Time falsely reported that President Trump removed a bust of Martin Luther King Jr. from the Oval Office. Boy, wasn't that a nice thing. Number five, we have Washington Post, okay, and they falsely reported the president's massive sold-out rally in Pensacola. This was for the election, senatorial election, in Alabama. He went down there to Pensacola, and it was a safe place to land. And he had an overwhelming crowd. It was sold out. It was not sold out because he doesn't charge anything to get in there. You couldn't find a seat in there. But anyway, number five, Washington Post falsely reported the president's massive sold-out rally in Pensacola was empty. Dishonest reporters showed picture of empty arenas hours before the crowd started pouring in. So he did that purposely. Number six, when Trump made a visit to Japan, CNN falsely edited a video to make it appear President Trump defiantly overfed fish during a visit with the Japanese Prime Minister. But the Japanese Prime Minister actually led the way with the feeding. I think what with the feed that was left in the box, you know, they both threw the Prime Minister, you know, threw in first the rest of the box. And I think Trump followed that by throwing in, you know, the rest of his box. See. So anyway, that was okay. Number seven, CNN falsely reported about Anthony Scaramucci's meeting with a Russian, but retracted it due to significant breakdown in process, it said. Okay, and that and during that misreporting, three CNN employees resigned over a retracted story on Russia ties. Number eight, Newsweek falsely reported that the Polish First Lady Agata Kornhauser Duda did not shake President Trump's hand, but she did. I mean, this press is something else. And Melania Trump is sitting there watching it. Number nine, CNN falsely reported that former FBI Director James Comey would dispute President Trump's claim that he was told he is not under investigation. Another misreporting from CNN. Number 10, the New York Times falsely claimed on the front page that the Trump administration had hidden a climate report. Well, they were wrong on that again, see. So, you know, New York Times guilty of large screw-up on climate change story. They had to, but the, when they retract these things, it's always on the back page. I remember one time they retracted a story or put a very, very, very detrimental story about some staff member, one of the state's U.S. senators, that got caught drug dealing. They put it in the middle of the classified ad section in the back of the paper. Boy, that was something. Okay, here we got number 11. And last but not least, Russian collusion. Russian collusion is perhaps the greatest hoax perpetrated on the American public. There is no collusion. And so those were the 10 things that that he set out. And here he goes on to say, while the media spent 90% of the time focused on negative coverage of fake news, the president has been getting results. Number one, the economy has created nearly 2 million jobs and gained over $8 trillion in wealth since the president's inauguration. Number two, African Americans and Hispanics are enjoying the lowest unemployment rate in recorded history. Number three, the president signed historical tax cuts and relief for hard-working Americans not seen since President Reagan. Number four, President Trump's plan to cut regulations has exceeded 2 out of every 1 in mandate, issuing 22 deregulatory actions for every 1 new regulatory action. Number five, the president has unleashed an American energy boom by ending Obama-era regulations, approving the Keystone Pipeline, auctioning off millions of new acres for energy exploration, and opening up ANWR. ISIS, number six, is in retreat, having been crushed in Iraq and Syria. Number seven, President Trump followed through on his promise to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of the state of Israel, instructed the State Department to begin to relocate the embassy. Number eight, with President Trump's encouragement, more member nations are paying their fair share for the common defense in the NATO alliance. Number nine, he signed the Veterans Accountability and Whistleblower Protection Act to allow senior officials in the VA to fire failing employees and establish a safeguard to protect whistleblowers. And number 10, President Trump kept his promise and appointed Associate Justice Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court. So it's been a very successful year for President Trump. And so what remains now, and earlier in this hour, I played several of the clips there that that Hannity has been, publicizing and exposing. And what we have here is we have a gigantic series of. There is one thing I want to make a note of, the Uranium One. Let's get back to Uranium One and talk a little bit about that before we finish out this program tonight. Uranium One was originally a Canadian company, okay? And it originated and founded in Canada, okay? The Russians began to have an interest and ambitions to do more in the uranium mining business. And so there's a 9-member committee that must approve all foreign investments that might impact our national security. So Hillary Clinton, being Secretary of State at the time, sat as the chairman on that committee. So it was very, very critical that, to get that vote. Well, the Soviet Union was coming in and Russia, I should say at this time, was coming in and wanting to buy an interest. And it just so happened that Hillary and them were, you know, open to the Russia acquiring an interest. Well, they did acquire an interest, okay, initially. And then they that was about 19% interest in the company. The company owned about 20% of our uranium production in this country, even though it was a Canadian company. It had no license to export that uranium that they mined in this country overseas. Later, Russia, and you can go into the internet and look, go into Uranium One site on the internet, I advise you to, and look at their timeline on what they did and when they did it, see. But Kazakhstan figures prominently in this, and I'll tell you how in just a few minutes. Russia acquired interest, and today Russia owns totally Uranium One outright. But there were three steps that they had to take to gain full control and ownership. The first step was acquiring 19%, which Hillary and her committee approved. The second step was acquiring 51 to 52%, which Hillary and them also approved. Before the second approval of the 51 and 52% ownership, which acquired total control of the company by the Russians, they had acquired, Uranium One had acquired two of the largest and most productive uranium mines in Kazakhstan. Those two mines, Uranium One acquired 50% interest in both of those mines. That meant that Russia, even before they acquired the 52% interest, 51-52%, began to see Uranium One as a very prized because of the Kazakhstan mines. Now, what happened next was Hillary and them did approve the acquisition of the interest that took the Russian interest to 51-52%. Since that time, the Russians have acquired outright ownership of Uranium One, and they're also shipping from these interests. And there were problems also that came up recently about certain exports from Uranium One from America to Canada. Now, that's just another question that must be investigated. So everyone is calling for an investigation of Uranium One, and I think it's already begun, okay? Not much less the Clinton Foundation. But what they're going to find in Uranium One is that the Russians begin to not only acquire interest, uranium interest here in this country, but they acquired the interest that were primary interest in Kazakhstan. Now, today, Uranium One is one of the leading mining corporations in the world, and they have been shipping back from Russia to a reprocessing plant in Paducah, Kentucky, that material to be processed and then to be used by our power plants. Now, I dug down into that corporation, and that corporation has many of its directors or advisors that are former national security advisors to both parties, both administrations, whether it's a Republican administration or it's a Democratic administration. They're both national security advisors on both sides. And that company had been taken private too, which at one time it was a government, because it's so highly regulated and had to do and impacted on national security interests. It was always a government controlled entity, corporation. Now, since then, it's been taken private, and you have all these former national security advisors in there as either directors, advisors, or whatever. So, what we have is that what we have overall, and I'll just tell you what I think's going on, is if you remember the 007 and the James Bond books that came out a number of years ago, there was an organization, there were two organizations vying for world dominance. One of them was called Spectre, and then there was a Russian, counterpart, and I forget the name of that. That's not matter, it's just the idea here that we're talking about. But anyway, when you begin to dig down and you study the world system, you begin to see that, number one, the people that are can control are controlling it through money power. And so we're talking about mammon. If you're a Christian and you've studied mammon, the good book says you can only have one, you know, God before thee, either God or mammon. And if you worship one, the other will scorn you or hate you. And so today, through a money system that's been evolved out of Rothschild interest and banking interest and the City of London financial interest and so forth, a pecking order of money power and money control has been created, with usury being the barter fuel to fuel the whole system. So what we see now is that after these money interests had gained control, they moved into the ownership of the central banks was a key to them owning, so they could issue credits and expand their interest. But also, they began to place people that were loyal to them and that were their agents into intelligence operations throughout the Western world. So today, they've moved in and they have not only banking interest through the ownership of central banks, but they've moved many of their agents into top intelligence operatives. Le Cercle is an organization that meets twice a year, and these are primarily made up of intelligence chiefs from the main Western countries' intelligence agencies. They meet twice a year. It's all private. It's secret. Everything is secret. They don't publicize their meetings. They meet once, usually in Washington, D.C., and then once overseas, usually in Europe. We've been following that for a number of years, and the Habsburgs were involved with them at one time, and even David Rockefeller, when he was living, and he was the chairman of Manhattan, Chase Manhattan, he joined that group and then was advised by some of his directors on the board of Chase Manhattan to step back out of that because it was too public, and they preferred that he keep a lower profile in those kinds of groups. The Le Cercle group has brought about the United States of Europe in the form of the European Union. So that was one of their, Jean Monnet was the mover shaker in that group. There was the Panay group and so forth that preceded that. You could say the Synergist, that time, look, people, the owners of that got caught up in this country, were also Synergist. When I'm saying synergism, I'm talking about an idea to control and run political systems from behind the scenes, with secret societies being the Nixus group, or the foundational group, but operating in secrecy with secret members, and then because they're money dominated and their money power dominated, then they own and control the political systems, and they own and control the central banks. So that's what we're up against today as far as when anyone ever says anything about the deep state or the national, you could say, security state and so forth. This has been mushroomed and has evolved into a very, very powerful complex or cartels. So they started in this country in working, like the JFK thing was one of the things that you saw the organized crime along with our intelligence agencies come together and then execute JFK in Dealey Plaza on November 22nd, 1963. As this whole power system evolved and they got richer through banking interest and corporate interest, they began to resemble something like a international, you could say, money, banking, financial, corporate, criminal enterprise. The criminal enterprises were usually hidden within, you know, their national security, intelligence agencies that they control. Because they'll go ahead and label something that an operation, and they'll put a classified, heading on it, and then work these black ops or these black operations through secrecy. And that's basically what has evolved, is that we have international, financial, corporate, criminal cartels Sometimes they'll work together on projects. Sometimes they won't. You could say that they started out robbing old ladies' handbags on the streets of New York, and now they plunder whole countries. And that's what's beginning to happen now, is they'll go in and they'll take over the mineral interest or the mining interest and the natural resources of countries, and they'll just start, you know, just taking everything they out as quick as they can. And this was very evident, happened in Indonesia. There, Sukarno had become friendly to JFK. And Sukarno had very valuable mineral interests and also oil interests that these cartels, these oil and money cartels, wanted. And they saw Sukarno as a nationalist, see, and someone that was in their way, okay? And so they had to remove him and get rid of him to gain the mineral and the oil interests later. I'm going to play something. Fareed is a national, you could say, internationalist type person. He's not really on our side, but he sort of lays out some of the things about the followers of Trump. And I'm going to play that, and then we're going to end up with a few comments after that and close down this first hour. But listen carefully about this. Fareed has some very insightful things to say about who are the supporters of President Trump. Here we go now.
Whether you put them in a basket or not, the question of this election is, who are Donald Trump's supporters? One way to answer is to widen the scope beyond the United States. Trump is part of a broad populist trend running across the Western world. Over the last few decades, we've seen the rise of populism, both left-wing and right-wing, from Sweden to Greece, Denmark to Hungary. In each place, the discussion tends to focus on forces that are particular to each country and its political landscape. But it's happening in so many countries with so many different political systems, cultures, and histories that there must be some common causes. In an important research paper for Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, Ronald Engelhardt and Pippa Norris calculate that European populist parties of the right and left have gone from 6.7% and 2.4% of the vote in the 1960s, respectively, to 13.4% and 12.7% in the 2010s. The most striking finding of the paper, which points to a fundamental cause for this rise of populism, is the decline of economics as the pivot of politics. The way we think about politics today is still shaped by the basic 20th century left-right divide. Left-wing parties advocated for increased government spending, a larger welfare state, and regulations on business. Right-wing parties wanted limited government, fewer safety nets, and more laissez-faire policies. Voting patterns reinforced this ideological divide, with the working class voting for the left and middle and upper classes for the right. Engelhardt and Norris note that the old voting patterns have been declining for decades. By the 1980s, they write, class voting had fallen to the lowest levels ever recorded in Britain, France, Sweden, and West Germany. In the United States, it had fallen so low by the 1990s that there was virtually no room for further decline. Today, an American's economic status is a far worse predictor of his or her voting preferences than her views on same-sex marriage. The authors also analyzed party platforms in recent decades, and they found that since the 1980s, economic issues have become much less important. Non-economic issues, social, environmental, have greatly increased in importance. As economics declined as the central force defining politics, its place was taken by a grab bag of issues that could be described as culture. It began, as Engelhardt and Norris note, with young people in the 1960s embracing a post-materialist politics, self-expression, gender, race, environmentalism. That trend then generated a backlash from older voters, particularly men, who sought to reaffirm the values that they grew up with. The key to Donald Trump's success in the Republican primaries was to realize that while the conservative establishment preached the economic gospel of free trade, low taxes, deregulation, and entitlement reform, conservative voters were moved by very different non-economic appeals, about immigration, security, and identity. This is the new landscape of politics, and it explains why partisanship is so high, rhetoric so shrill, and compromise seemingly impossible. You see, you could split the difference on economics. After all, money can always be divided. But how do you compromise on the core issue of identity or national culture? You see, each side today holds deeply to a vision of America and believes genuinely that what its opponents want is not just misguided, but, well, deplorable.
Boy, I tell you what, he described it. He didn't describe it quite like I would have. But basically, what happened was many people got up off their couch and they were motivated by really patriotic issues. I think that President Trump, deep down, he really loves this country. Unlike Obama, which I think Obama despised this country. That's what my opinion of Barack Obama. And I think that was because of his conditioning through his real father in Hawaii and so forth. And his surrounding influences in Chicago and so forth and so on. So I think that was the big difference, is that Barack Obama, I don't believe, loved this country at all. Despised it, in my opinion. And then along comes President Trump. He has some ethical issues in his past, which, you know, people would ignored because his other interest and his real sincerity about doing what was right and working for the American public begin to shine through, okay, and overshadowed some of his past problems. Hillary, on the other hand, and Bill, they had very, very deep and dark problems coming out of Arkansas with bodies all around. And then she had problems with the Clinton Foundation and the Uranium One and all kinds of other problems. And so that's the choice that the American public was presented was, do I vote for Hillary? But, you know, Benghazi problems and all this devastation of Libya, and a very hateful person, really. Or do I go for Trump, who's had some business problems in the past and some bankruptcies, but his sincerity about wanting to do what was right for the American public, he was right on. He had been captured by the neocons to a certain degree, so he's off on his foreign relations and foreign policies, in my opinion. But he has done a lot, and he's really, the promises he made, he's come through on several of those. So you can't say the man didn't try to come through. He's working for a better America, a more solvent America, you could say, one that can possibly get more jobs, and the black unemployment is way down, and the Hispanic unemployment is way down, and the jobs are coming back, see. And so he is doing what he says he's going to do, and he's a no BS guy. Now he's a pragmatist more than anything. I think that's the best way to see him. He has this really deep-seated love for this country, a very patriot. It does spill over into authoritarianism sometimes, which is not a good suit for him. But otherwise, his ethical problems are in the past. He's trying to end his career and his legacy and his life with doing the right thing for this country. And I think that's going to bring him through, you know, real well. But anyway, we want to thank you for listening tonight. And we value each and every person. And each life out there is precious. It doesn't matter what you look like or whatever you may appear to be. Each life is precious, and we honor each and every life in this world, in this universe. But thank you for listening, and thank you so very much tonight. And God bless you. Good night.